No.
Yes, that's right.
Was it September 9th?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I know. Okay, so I've started this.
Oh, there he is. Could it be October 9th?
No, it was September 9th.
Time flies, he doesn't have any fun,
right?
No.
You're looking younger, we've aged. Okay.
Hi.
Hello. I'm Tom Stan.
Yes, sir.
Yes, we are. Yes. So we're here. It's October the 25th, around 2:40 p.m. This is a continuation of an earlier interview with Sabes Siddique, former Federal Reserve head of credit component. We are recording this interview. Sabes, can we get your approval for that recording? Or
okay. Sure. Yes.
Yes. And we're still working for the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and we're still writing a book that's under Congress. We're still bipartisan.
Okay.
So same mission, same purpose. So
so while you're here, are you still representing the Fed, or is it
research?
Research.
So yeah. For me, it's research, you know.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's pretty easy. Yeah.
Okay.
But he means you're working full time for that in this life as for the SCIC.
Yeah. For like another week.
Right. So you're not the Fed representative.
No.
Or any of other agency.
There is no Fed representative here.
No.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
It's just the team.
Okay.
Yeah. It works pretty well. Maybe we should go around the room so that for the recording we'll have all the names. I'm Steve Sandiford, S-A-N-D-E-R-F-O-R-D, on loan from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond as a researcher for the FCIC.
Mm-hmm. Joel Miller with the research team as well, FCIC.
I'm sorry, so where were you before?
I'm on a detail from the OCC.
Okay.
Kirsten Downey, I'm a writer. I was a business reporter at the Washington Post for 20 years.
Okay.
Left the Post, and I'm now writing books, and including this book.
Mm-hmm. I'm Alexis Simmendinger. I'm also part of the writing team. I also was a journalist, and I'm part of the writing team for the FCIC.
Okay.
Malana Vickers, I'm one of the writers for the report also.
Okay.
Tom Stanton, I'm not on detail from any place. I teach at Johns Hopkins and do a lot of writing, but I'm on the research staff.
Okay.
Donna Norman, and I'm on detail from the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Right.
Sabes, can we?
Sabes Siddiq, I'm with Deloitte Touche right now, and joined Deloitte about 9 weeks ago now, since from the Federal Reserve Board.
That's right. So this is a short time for you as well. I mean, it seems like, wow, that doesn't seem like 9 weeks.
Yeah.
The last time, maybe this is the place to start, you talked to us. We were asking questions about, you know, what was happening at the Fed, you know, very in a timely way, around what was occurring with mortgages. And you talked about some detailed analysis. We asked Dave Caperton for those documents.
Oh,
We've had some really good follow-up.
Oh, good.
With others, you know, within the Fed. What was going on, what were the discussions, but maybe we want to follow up with some questions, and Joel, did we have, so just so that you're, these came out of your group.
Can you tell us that these are what you prepared?
Yep, traditional.
I think one of them, there's two documents, one dated November 1st of 05 and one dated November 30th of 05.
Mm-hmm. Yep, these look familiar. Right.
Just so we are all in the same place, so did you prepare them? If so, what was the occasion that you prepared them for? Who was the audience? That sort of thing.
So here you have the audience. Here is the joint CSRA and President's meeting. So this was... Right, so this was some governors and presidents.
Okay, that one's dated later, though, in
May 10th, 2006.
Right, and the cover page, though, says
November 1st, 2005.
To be fair, there were a lot of documents in that stack, mm-hmm. and the first, like, 14 pages mm-hmm. look like early, and mm-hmm. then later in the process, there's, like, a printout of the non-traditional right. guidance. That's later.
So early on, it was probably a few governors, and then eventually it was the presidents, if I remember correctly.
In 2006.
Yeah, in 2006, by the time it was 2006, it was more, okay, this is what we're going to do. Do you guys, are you all on board? And so, you know, that's when I think I mentioned some governors didn't support it. I think I mentioned that.
Yes.
And the reason for, I think, part of this meeting was because we were getting a lot of, you know, we were getting pushback from different parts of the Reserve Banks. Right. So this is all November, right.
Mm-hmm. How was the San Francisco Reserve Bank, given all the stuff that was going on in California? Were they pretty supportive of your concerns?
San Francisco was probably, they were silent. I mean, I wouldn't say they opposed it, but in our data gathering, they were supportive.
Because how did you know that?
Oh, just from the attitudes of the examiners that we dealt with at the Reserve Banks, because we had to go to Wells and Countrywide, and usually the examiners' attitude are somewhat reflective of the president's, and so that's so they were quite cooperative.
The proposed non-traditional mortgage guidance mm-hmm. went out in late December of 2005, mm-hmm. interagency, mm-hmm. and then it was ultimately finalized in October of 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess leading up to the proposal, it looks like your PowerPoint, the mm-hmm. residential mortgage lender mm-hmm. peer group survey,
mm-hmm.
that was done prior to the proposed guidance, mm-hmm. and I guess in our last discussion you explained how that mm-hmm. proposal came to pass,
mm-hmm.
but what I'd like a little more better understanding of is how did people react within the Fed to this presentation that you gave on mm-hmm. what you found, this mm-hmm. peer group assessment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Were they surprised at the results? What was the reaction?
Yeah, I think they were. There were some surprising elements to it. That is the tremendous amount of risk layering that was going on, and obviously the rapid growth in this was also. Some of a surprise from what I remember, but it was the risk layering that seemed to be what stood out the most. And risk layering includes investor type loans, and then low doc no doc type of loans, and then marketing those to low FICO bands. Borrowers.
So as of November of 2005, were there still people at the board who thought guidance was unnecessary?
There was some pushback, yes, because the view was that the markets would, this would stifle innovation, because we were specifically making some strong supervisory recommendations. There were two or three, as you know, probably know what they are, right? And so that was changing the securitization markets and origination markets. So they didn't feel that that was necessary because it would stifle innovation. And secondly, the home ownership, which is a key American dream tenant, you know, everybody should try to be, everybody should be, as many people as possible that can afford a home should be able to have a home. You know, many felt that that sort of principle would be compromised as well.
Can I ask, in the present, the concept of risk layering in the audience, when you read comments, you know, after the ANPR or the NPR folks came in, and you know, there were descriptions of scenarios where these mortgages with the unusual features, low doc, for instance, were appropriate, and mm-hmm. there were examples given by mm-hmm. you know, the industry. Was there a similar understanding of what the risk layering was inside the Fed group, or was the data? I mean, it's pretty mm-hmm. well laid out. It's pretty clear. Mm-hmm. Were they? Do you think they were aware of what the implications were?
Well, I mean,
sort of their understanding yeah. level.
So you know, they, you know, some of their views were. You know, the access of credit was now given to people that didn't have access before, and that's not necessarily a negative thing.
Right.
And the view of you know, home ownership is positive. It's something good for overall financial stability, overall financial, overall economy, and. So I don't think anybody was thinking about a 30-40% decline in home ownership and then the ramifications associated with that
right.
at that time. They were really thinking about the effects on probably on credit availability
right.
and you know, the effect on the economy. Yeah, is it actually going to maybe have a negative impact on the economy versus the and credit availability to masses that didn't have credit before.
What did you think after looking at the details?
Well, I mean, the guidance, you know, I was in support of the guidance, which was, you know, you should focus on credit fundamentals, mm-hmm. and I wasn't an economist, so I didn't, you know, financial stability is part of my responsibility, but not in the terms of thinking about it, way an economist might think about it. So my personal feeling was, again, I think I said this before, is if you have the fundamentals right to begin with in the beginning, then that provides a layer of protection and buffer that, you know, doesn't solve all the problems, but it provides a layer of buffer that you wouldn't otherwise have.
Can I ask you, did you get all the way through the presentation? Did you get it all the way through with your audience? Did you go all the way through every slide?
No.
How far did you get? Do you remember?
Well, it depends on the presentation. Let's see here. So let me think about this. So this one, probably, I remember this one because I was on the hot seat on this one.
And this one's the November 1st, 2005
yeah,
version.
Right. And
what does it mean to be on the hot seat?
Well, everyone's staring at you, and you know, all the presidents are asking you questions. So I think we got through maybe... probably like 7 slides of this.
Mm-hmm. And then the other one.
This other one, this detailed one,
mm-hmm.
This one was, I think it was, I think a certain presentation, we gave a number of these. So certain presentations, we got through it all, if I remember correctly. I do remember speaking through these slides. That's what
so
I remember.
Can you tell us, who were the highest level Fed officials who saw some or all of that 2005 presentation?
Well, it was Rich Spillenkoffen. He was the division director. He saw it, and he was big supporter of this. And so basically, without his support, we wouldn't have gotten this done. So he was basically supporting it. And then after that, a big proponent was the vice chairman, Ferguson, and Governor Baez, Sue Baez. They were definitely, and behind that was Greenspan. So I think, you know, in a way, Chairman Greenspan got a negative publicity in this cycle. But nobody really, I mean, what he did was, because he used, this is my view, I don't know if this was actually the case, but my view is that he tried these different tools that monetary policy economists have, but those tools were not working. So he finally called supervision folks to see if they could issue guidance to control this market, because he was worried. So even though he raised the rates, the long-term rates remained relatively flat, and the mortgage markets continued to grow, which he was worried about. So he tried to control the markets through issuing guidance, which the vice chairman, Ferguson, was essentially his strong arm man, you know, his mouthpiece. So he said, get this done as soon as possible.
Did Chairman Greenspan see all the data?
I don't recall presenting it to him.
Okay. Did you have any...
I think vice chairman probably did.
Okay. So you don't have any way of knowing one way or the other whether Chairman Greenspan had the data that you had pulled together?
No, I can't remember.
Okay.
But
your understanding of the assignment that you had is that he was behind.
I'm sure. I don't think Vice Chairman Ferguson would feel that strongly without his backing.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me make sure I clarify, because when you were here last, I thought that you were talking about the bank survey as something that you initiated in your group. It wasn't an assignment from above. Is that wrong? Am I remembering that wrong?
There was a stress test that I conducted that wasn't initiated, but the surveys, we had been doing these surveys beforehand, and so we've been doing it, but when it became interagency, then it became much more, you know, a formalized sort of approach. Yeah.
Talk about the stress test.
The stress test came afterwards, and so our group did a stress test, about a year before the actual stress test.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the results of that stress test, it'll show a lot of the banks that were that actually got into trouble. Got into trouble.
What would that be? 06?
Warning. Hmm?
No,
that's about a year before we did the financials.
The stress test. February of 2009.
Right. Right. So we did one in 2008. I presented it to certain reserve banks, and I gave it to the supervision folks. And I sent it up to New York, and then so when they came up with the methodology of the final stress test, I said, "Well, this looks familiar."
And it must have looked familiar to Mr. Geithner. Yes, because you sent it to him.
I sent it to New York and his group.
Right.
So I can't say he saw it directly,
right, but
his people saw it. Yeah, right. But, you know, again, I it could be coincidence, because it's not rocket science. This is just doing stresses on the balance sheet and looking at the impact on capital.
Right.
That's what bankers do, you know. That's what, so as a credit, as a former lender, before you make a loan to any commercial borrower, you stress their balance sheet. And so, this idea, I was saying, okay, let's see the financial viability of the banking system. And so the Fed has a capability of coming up with all the exposure. It's basically creating a balance sheet. So our group, our credit risk, and you can ask Brian Valenti this, we do have a balance sheet, income statement, and cash flow of the entire financial system. And so we stress the entire financial system, and then we looked at by bank. And so it just, you know, it was a simple thing, and I talked to Nelly Liang. So the way that this came about is I talked to Nelly Liang in monetary policy, and she would ask us about views on losses on different asset classes that would go into this research to monetary policy. So I suggested to Nelly, wouldn't it be interesting to see how those, if you use those losses, what the impact would be on banks' balance sheets. So she would have views on losses, and I would say, well, our examiner views are X versus her view, and she would adjust them. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, let me take a look at what your final numbers are that you're giving to the board, and I will use those numbers and see what the impact has on the banks itself.
And what time period are we talking about here?
This was, again, about a year before.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's ample evidence that people were very plugged into what was happening, at least at that point in time, right?
Mm-hmm.
No,
yeah.
No mystery as to what was happening.
Oh, in the middle of the financial crisis, I think that perhaps there was still an underestimation of the number of banks that would be affected by the crisis. Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And what makes you say that?
Oh, just from my conversations in the cafeteria and all that, you know, just they'd say, "Sabeth, how's it going? You know, what do you think?" And I said, "There are probably a few thousand banks that are going to be affected, and there's really, you know." So from those kinds of conversations, I could tell that the severity of the situation hasn't been fully realized.
Was there a point in time when the mood shifted from thinking about this as a regionally spotty problem to thinking of it as a more of a national problem? What was that about?
That was probably during the summer of 2007. Summer of 2007.
What makes you remember this so
well? Right, because the president of Countrywide called me over the weekend. I was in my office, and asked for something that changed. That was when it changed. That's when it all started.
So Mr. Mozzillo called you?
The president.
Oh, the president called you.
Right.
Sandoval called you.
Yeah.
And what did he ask?
He asked for some help from the Fed, and I think one of them was the 23A exemption. And so we went to Bernanke soon thereafter, and then told him about it, and including the fact that we have to stop saying that the subprime mortgages are well contained.
Mm-hmm. Now, why would he call you? I'm missing something.
Because what happened is I had asked Brian to call them to find out what's happening in the market.
Which Brian are you talking about?
Brian Valenti.
Okay.
Yeah. So what happened is I asked Brian, call them up, and I'm going to join you in 10 minutes in the meeting. If I get some market color, call up one of their analysts.
Okay.
And so I went into the meeting 10 minutes later. The president was on the phone. And I said, Brian, you didn't have to call the president to get market color. He said no, he wanted to be there. So I said, okay, fine. So they were very, very good about one thing about Countrywide is they had lots of data, lots of information about there. I think they had probably one of the best MIS systems in the mortgage business. So they were a good source.
There's a certain irony in that sense.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Right. So So they had a lot of good information, and so he went in the meeting, and he was in the meeting. So that's how. So he knew.
So what did he say that helped you see? I mean, just explain more about how he helped you be persuaded this was definitely a national problem?
Well, it was that weekend when he called, and I couldn't just hold, because he asked for the Fed to do something about it, right? So I had to bubble up the information,
right?
So that was my duty. So I bubbled it up, and then I think Deborah Bailey asked me to go with her to go see the chairman. And so we went to go see the chairman and said, you know, you got to stop saying this. And then he said, well, maybe you should go talk to, you know, X, Y, and Z. And so we went to talk to some of the economists, and, you know, there was an element of surprise.
And then what happened after that?
They stopped saying it's well contained. No, they we there was a whole slew of meetings afterwards.
That's such a good story. All right.
So what wasn't that?
That's early on. I mean, by August.
This is really early.
There were market events.
Yeah, no, that was the, those were the beginnings. That's when I clearly remember things changing at the Fed. That right after that day, it just changed.
You identified that as summer 07. Do you remember when?
It was July or August, somewhere around there.
Wasn't. Maybe I have the, do I have the year wrong? Countrywide was on the ropes then and got bailed out partly by B of A, wasn't it?
Right.
Right around then?
Right. It was soon after that.
Yeah. So they needed the 23A exemption right before that.
And that's what they're asking partially for.
Right.
The 23A exemption.
That's when we sent in the troops, looked at the quality of the collateral. That's when the commercial paper market. Now, the whole subprime crisis started, one could argue it started before then, right? Because of all these things, right?
Yeah.
This is when we could have done something back here, right? But we didn't.
Can I ask about that? Well, you issued the non-traditional.
We issued the non-traditional,
guidance.
The market, still didn't believe it. They were pushing back, you know, and.
Back then, which one do you mean specifically?
The non-traditional mortgage guidance.
So would that be at September, November 2005?
Five, and then when did we
November
issue the subprime guidance? So soon after that.
Oh, six, right.
The proposal was in December of 05, but it took 9 or 10 months till October.
So it's 07.
Of 06.
06.
The subprime is actually, I think, 2000.
For the final interagency.
Right, so I think the final came out of this in 2007, right?
October of 06.
06?
On the non-traditional.
Right, or 06. Then subprime came out in 07, in early 07.
So, Ben, can we follow, because when we talked previously, you talked about that, and, you know, kind of what was the impetus for the additional guidance? It seemed like it had been pretty clear to you that, I think you mentioned a 327 would be covered by the non-traditional mortgage. There was some disagreement.
There was a footnote in the non-traditional mortgage guidance that would probably allow the 228s and 327s to be excluded from it. And that was the oversight on our part.
And who put that in?
We did.
Oh, interesting.
When you say oversight,
that
really was an oversight?
Yes.
Yeah, that was unintended, right?
It was unintended,
and Susan Boyes thought that it was included, right?
Yes.
Right.
We thought it was included.
Right.
I mean, if you look at the tenets of what we said in non-traditional versus what we say in subprime, they're very similar.
Right.
It was almost exact duplicate.
So that was there. I'm sorry.
I wonder if you can talk about. There's kind of two themes that are interesting to me here. One is, and of course, you're not, Alan. You know, you're not. You can't be in Greenspan's head, and I'm not suggesting that you can be. But it's very interesting that you would say that. Did I understand you right to say that he felt frustration at his inability to get the results from interest rate modifications?
That was my impression.
Market response.
That was my impression.
So I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that piece and also elaborate on on the guidance piece and frustration in the Fed about the ineffectiveness of the instruments they had at their disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third piece is, if you had all those guys on your side, you know, who was it that was putting you in the hot seat? Maybe you can tell a little bit more about that and why.
Right. So part of this is conjecture on my part, right? So it's like putting two and two together, so I'm not sure it's actually the case. So so just from attending these board meetings, briefings, which you know, we have, which the Fed has every two or three weeks, I sensed that, you know, that he was talking about, the Greenspan was talking about this, right? And a concern about long-term rates remaining relatively low, mortgage rates. And then the fact that he didn't really believe in supervision. He believed in market discipline, right? Didn't really want us to interfere in the markets. And Vice Chairman Ferguson was his, you know, his right-hand man. And so all of a sudden it became a... It became very urgent for us to issue this guidance. It became very urgent.
Yeah, there was a change of heart.
Change in heart, yeah. So so that's why I think, and something like that, as meaningful as that guidance, I mean, as given the amount of attention it got and the potential impact it had on the market, the fact that Chairman Greenspan did not oppose it, because he was a big market discipline person, meant that he was behind it, to me.
But now, Susan Vyse told us that some people did not want to, for example, make the guidance stronger because they worried that it would make the playing field uneven. Was
right.
that, to you, one of the main reasons to not make it stronger than it was?
Right. So the level playing field was part of it. Stifling innovation was another part of it. Yes.
But and did Ferguson or Greenspan or any other person push?
It was not Ferguson.
Not Ferguson. Who what?
That opposed it.
Who did oppose it?
You know, some other governors.
Can you be a little bit more?
I can't remember, actually, sorry.
Birthday, favorite food.
Well, what about regionally? You mean, back to Tom's question earlier.
Well, it was in San Francisco.
It was. Was it in or was it not?
Was not.
It was not opposed to this.
No.
Can we go to the right. Seems that the language that changed between the, and I'm looking at these dates, right, the final rule for the non-traditional mortgage, which was 2006, and then the subprime follow-up that was 2007, it seemed like another piece of language that was sort of, it was the 228-327 thing was emphasized, but also the non-banks.
Mm-hmm.
Had that been a development that, you know, the level playing field and, you know, non-banks are included too? I know when you argue with the other agencies, they always point to...
Well, the non-banks from the holding company perspective was included, but then the institutions outside of the
federal
supervision were not included.
Right.
So 40% of these mortgages were around there, were originated outside of the banking industry, right? And so... So that's the level playing field that they were arguing about. But the guidance specifically targeted non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies. It included those.
It did. Was it clear in 2006 that guidance would also affect non-bank subsidiaries of bank holding companies?
Yes, I remember specifically discussing that. And so that's certainly the intent.
Pushed it.
So that was certainly the intent. Whether it was clear, I'm not sure, but it was certainly the intent.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and assume that you mean New York. which you may or may not mean, but say theoretically it was New York, or that it was New York in
Well,
practice.
There were a number of governors. A number of governors.
Governors who would have put you in the hot seat over that.
How many do you think you would just ballpark?
Three or four. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a good number.
But can I just stick with New York mm-hmm. for a minute? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. that is so interesting that, mm-hmm. in a sense, Greenspan mm-hmm. is, at least in the mm-hmm. public mind, something mm-hmm. of a bad guy. Mm-hmm. But maybe you can recall for us just stuff from your own experience mm-hmm. that would have shown pressure from New York Fed officials. Into the message or the findings that you were trying to bring to the forefront.
I'd rather not do that.
You'd rather, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I think the floor is yours. Just
yeah. I'd rather not say.
And how about Bernanke?
He was very supportive. You know, he was quiet and very supportive. There was a lot of heat that we were under throughout the whole the non-traditional mortgage and even the commercial real estate guidance. Yes. And he was quiet. But he did not.
Quiet, but he didn't oppose.
He did not oppose. He was supportive in that sense, very supportive.
Maybe let Tom ask some questions. I've been in these interviews, mm-hmm. and he's. I think you'll enjoy his questions.
And so, in Countrywide's case, we were trying to, in the later stage, employ tighter bank-like supervision on the non-bank. And that was one of the reasons he moved to OTS.
Okay. If a firm is doing risk management well and has an enterprise-wide view, uh-huh. then I assume it's relatively easy for a supervisor to figure out where risk is located, or at least to get a better idea than otherwise. What about the problem when a firm gets it wrong and simply doesn't know its own risk that it's running? And I'm thinking things like warehouse lines of credit. Gee, we're backing out of the subprime market, mm-hmm. but all these people had pipelines back, not all, but many, et cetera.
Right. So one of the checks of that, and this is not necessarily perfect, but one of the checks is the horizontal analysis that examiners do. And so if a bank is a clear outlier in their risk assessment, we would try to, look into that. Obviously, the flaw in that is if everybody's wrong at the same time, then, you're wrong. And so that was one of the reasons of the financial crisis. We have a certain sheep-like mentality, herd-like mentality, that exists in the market, and I would say regulators are not completely immune to that either. And so I think, focusing on strong ratings, reliance on rating agency ratings, and all of that stuff, as you've heard before, that had an impact. But one check against that is the horizontal analysis, and also transaction testing by examiners themselves.
And they will do that, and they're able to do that.
Well, what had happened during the financial crisis is that a move towards a reliance on processes and controls and less reliance on transaction testing. Mm-hmm. So the view that if the bank's processes and controls were good, then the likelihood of risks being missed were very low. And so what we've learned from this financial crisis is we need to do, regulators need to do both, mm-hmm. Both transaction testing and also the process of controls. And the third element is making sure there's adequate capital. So this whole movement on Basel III and what regulators are focusing on now is adequacy of capital, which is leads to transaction testing in a way, because you have to make sure the loss estimates that the banks are trying to project are accurate and reasonable under different scenarios, and therefore they have capital, adequate capital. And there, and then Basel III, as you know, is bumping up capital for liquidity. So
we talked to some people in thinking of horizontal input, and we sort of got feedback that said, gee, if it's a smaller or regional bank, they're eager for the input from other institutions. If it's a very large, complex financial institution, they may or may not be eager for input from an examiner. And that seemed to be one reason that Governor Baez was pushing in the mid-2000s to create the large, complex institution, regional, small bank, horizontal reviews, and also specialist reviews, the derivatives and mortgage securitization, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious why that didn't work as well as intended, given that that sounds, to my mind, at least like a good idea, a good approach.
Right. I think partly because there are strong cultures that are in place in the Reserve Bank system that was hard to overcome. And that culture includes not giving Washington the information that they're looking for. So it's always been very, very difficult to get information out of the Reserve Banks throughout the years. And the responsibility for supervision has been delegated to the Reserve Bank. So invariably, when we would ask questions for information or data, they would say, everything's fine, don't worry about it. Right? And we would get tremendous pushback when I would try to get data, and it wasn't easy. And so I think Governor Baez tried to sort of change that, but there was a lot of opposition for her to get that done. And so I don't think it was completely successful. And so what you're seeing right now is a more centralization, more active participation by Washington in supervision. So you've heard of the recent reorg, and so the LISCC, which is now chaired by someone in Washington, before it was chaired by someone in the New York Fed. And so you would have these barriers, always before you'd have barriers to get information, because even though it was a centralized committee, it was controlled by the Reserve Banks. Now you have a committee that's controlled by the board, and you're also getting economists involved and others. So I think it's a good thing, because you will see more data. But I think the culture of it's still a well ingrained culture about distrust in Washington. I think that's got to change.
And from the examiner in charge perspective, say you're going into a large, complex institution, you've got a CEO. I mean, goodness knows we've looked at enough large institutions and didn't get it right now. And say an examiner sees something, what's the nature of that dialogue with a senior manager at one of these large, complex institutions? And what kind of ability does the examiner have to, I mean, it's easy if it's a Bank Secrecy Act or a compliance issue and you simply tag somebody, but where it's a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
A judgment which unfortunately proved right. What is the ability, say, mid-2000s of the examiner in charge to have that conversation in a reasonable way?
Yeah. Well, there's two things. The ability, and then there is the mechanism allowed to have that conversation, right? So an examiner can always have that conversation. Always could. And whether they had enough of those tough conversations, probably not. And so why else would we have rated capital to be adequate at JPMC, Citi, B of A? Right? We we said capital was fine. We rated it a 1. So obviously we didn't have the kinds of conversations we should have. But in certain institutions we did, and we did make some changes. So it all depends on, I think it's a people business, and I would say to some extent the kinds of people you have supervising certain institutions makes a difference.
Can I ask kind of a follow-up to Tom's question? And, it's a question that's been asked. There were a lot of ratings downgrades that were late in the process.
Yeah.
And there are a number of structural reasons, but you're probably more at the heart of what those reasons are. Can you talk about things that lead to late downgrades, friction, information, et cetera, in the process?
Yeah, I mean, basically you have a huge opposition from the reserve banks to make downgrades. Reserve banks are almost like, this is just me talking, reserve banks were, almost like the agents of the banks, and in some cases, not in all cases.
So it was the culture of the reserve bank itself.
The reserve banks pulling tooth out of them to change, to make a change in the ratings sometimes.
Can you give a practical illustration of opposition to downgrades?
Yeah, well,
see if you can think of one, early 2005, 2000.
Well, I mean, there's this one bank in the South that had, risk rating issues. They were not able to collate, their entire portfolio in a consistent manner. Different models, one model, in terms of the outputs, didn't come up with metrics that could make one compare one portfolio to another. So when you're trying to manage a portfolio, right, you want to be able to come up with metrics that make sense and also metrics that allow you to compare one portfolio to another, right? So there was lack of validation about the kinds of metrics that were provided and no controls or inadequate controls about benchmarking or comparability. Okay, that's just one example.
Did it have any housing relevance?
Sure. Housing, C&I, commercial real estate. This is a major bank. Mm-hmm. And, the local reserve banks just would not listen. It would be a tremendous fight to get them to change things or view it our way. At a point I just stopped going to reserve banks. I refused to go because
we have to explain to the layman. What was in the culture that made them so resistant? In other words, why were the incentives so strong to protect them?
I don't know, Steve would probably know better than me. He's at a reserve bank.
You're on the hot seat, though.
Maybe throw out something for conversation. And Joel and I've talked about this.
I'm asking him.
Okay.
I want to know what you think.
Partly because I'm not sure why it was like that. I think it was a culture that was like that before I came. So it just continued. It's like even if you're trying to be reasonable, it was just tremendous opposition. No, you don't know what you're talking about. We're here every day, and this is right.
Do you think it was influenced by the fact that major executives of the banks actually sat on the reserve?
Could be.
Did you have that impression?
No, I didn't think about that at that time, but I've heard of that.
Well, so and I mean, in the structure, their capital is in it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, fair enough that they have interests, their own bank interests, and in fact, the way the structure is, the boards of the regional feds, at least the Class A directors are meant to represent the interests of their banks. It's their job.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing would be to know whether in this crisis you you know, what kind of examples you saw of this sort of agency that in effect prevented the Fed from protecting the basics of the economy, you know, from.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think there was being too close to the situation, perhaps. Okay, so being too close to the situation, not seeing the big picture, and being too close to the relationship. You know, developed a relationship where it's tough to have these tough conversations.
And it's fair to say that was true in New York?
Yeah, I would say that.
Now we get pushback that there's a Chinese wall, and that the directors, even if they are from the regulated institutions, don't have a say on the supervisory side. Any sense of that, you know, that somehow is isolated in some way?
The directors from the board?
Of a Federal Reserve Regional Bank.
Yeah, that's true. I would say, yeah, I mean, there are, I can't say that those directors are, I haven't heard of any kind of blatant disregard for that governance, where they're directly influencing the supervision.
Well, one could imagine that they have an influence over the culture, which is where you start.
I think that would not be unreasonable to make that assumption.
I have another set of questions, but I'll defer.
Can I just follow up? Beth, you were giving an example of a bank where there seemed to be some pretty significant disagreements between how the credit folks in Washington were viewing it,
mm-hmm.
and the Reserve Bank.
Mm-hmm.
How did that play out? What happened to that bank?
Well, you know, I'm sort of in policy land and sort of going in providing technical assistance and training and developing policy. So I was not, you know, I didn't feel there was a culture of trying to, you know, fight the Reserve Banks without getting penalized for it. So I didn't feel like it was a fight worth fighting without having, you know, some negative ramifications. If you went against the Reserve Bank and you fought someone senior against Reserve Bank, and you did not have the backing of people in Washington, which then that's not a good situation to be in, because you could have your effectiveness going forward. Like if you call any other Reserve Bank, they won't even respond. Your name is tarnished. So you have to be very careful about how you handle those relationships.
So in terms of that particular bank, did it end up failing?
Didn't fail, but they had to raise, they were part of the SCAP exercise, and they have some fundamental issues, and
I need to understand the basics for what you're saying, and I'm sorry I don't.
Yeah, sure.
On the ground, looking at a bank, I assume it's people from the Federal Reserve Bank or looking at a holding company. How do you get your information, and how do you know what the examiners are seeing if they aren't coming from Washington? Or do I have
it's delegated to the Reserve Bank, so so for credit risk people, I had oversight of 1,000 examiners in the system, right, for credit risk. So the way I would have a monthly call with the examiners or 12 Reserve Banks, not all 1,000 of them, but some of the key leaders, and I would say, okay, what are you seeing? And what are some of your issues? And here's what I want you to focus on. And here's kind of the policies that you need to be mindful of. So that's pretty much how I worked, how we did things. Now, on certain occasions when we saw these, systemic issues like commercial real estate or mortgages, then we would have to get buy-in from all the reserve banks that we're going to conduct this survey. So when we do this survey, we get cooperation from the examiners to actually fill it out. And so I rely on my eyes and ears, or you will. So there's the Federal Reserve has the powerful piece of the Federal Reserve is it has 12 reserve banks, eyes and ears all over the country, right? And so how do you actually harness that strength? And so there's a lot of information within the reserve banks, a lot of expertise, resources, and within the reserve banks. My point is, one lesson learned is that we can learn from the inefficient use of those resources and do a better job going forward. In other words, we should all be one team instead of Washington coming in and being the bad guy.
I'm trying to understand, say, in the mid-2000s, mm-hmm. I'm an examiner in charge in one of the regional banks, mm-hmm. and I've nurtured some large complex institution.
Yeah.
And I'm encouraging, I'm prodding, that was a word we heard a lot of. Right. And so they're starting to move in the right direction, improve their information system, risk management, or whatever it is.
Right.
What incentive do I and this regional bank have when I'm on a call with you to say, well, you know, these guys really got problems, but I'm looking at it. Or versus just saying, you know, there's nothing out of the ordinary here, we're business as usual and things look pretty good.
Right. So what incentive do they have to call me?
To flow information up to you to let me get a picture.
Right. So the incentive is that in the case that Washington does send in examiners to look at certain situations and they find a big discrepancy between what the Reserve Bank is saying and what Washington found in a targeted exam or through a horizontal, that will not reflect well on the Reserve Bank.
Okay. So you have some checks on that?
We do. There are some checks to that. Yes.
Were there databases that you relied on that allowed you to look into each of the Reserve Bank's analysis of particular banks or holding companies? Could you do some sort of horizontal?
There's the call report. Yes, you know, the Y9Cs and what have you. But there is no consistent, and that's what we were trying to get to. And I would say you don't send in a target. It's very, if you do these targeted exams, it's met with a lot of resistance. So there is that check, but you get a lot of questions about why you're doing these things.
Particularly when the banks are making, the commercial banks are making money, is that
right? It's not easy to do that.
This sounds really frustrating to me to listen to you tell the story. You would expect that it wouldn't be that way. Was it frustrating to be dealing with that day in and day out, this delicate dance you were doing?
Oh yeah, it's very frustrating, absolutely.
And did it impede the effectiveness of Washington's ability to supervise, to examine, to look into anything?
Yeah,
learn?
I would say so, definitely.
And what has changed? Anything?
I would encourage you to analyze the situation and see if it has.
Do you have a sense of it?
I'd rather not say.
Okay.
Can I take you back to another input? Unless
I'm
cutting you off from...
I had a set of questions, or a few questions on risk management, but I can wait, depending on your time.
Yeah, and I have some questions, too.
Mm-hmm. You know, people are asking you about how information would flow to Washington,
mm-hmm.
And you mentioned two things earlier that make me more, so we've heard about how the regional feds impede mm-hmm. the flow of information. But you talked earlier about getting on and asking one of your staffers to call and collect mm-hmm. some market color, mm-hmm. which was an interesting term. And it was the result of that mm-hmm. that got you the countrywide news
right.
and set the ball in motion.
Right.
Now, you also mentioned that
you had your views, but you weren't an economist.
Mm-hmm.
And I, maybe I'm reading into what you're saying, but what I was reading into it was that the culture of the Fed is, if you ain't an economist, no thank you to your macro views.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you can elaborate on that. You know, you're in a position where you collect this market color as part of your work, and it doesn't go to inform the views of the professional economists. Can you address that? And in the context of this period and what you saw. And
right. So you notice I call the bank directly rather than calling the examiners to get the information. So why I did that is because I had to start developing relationships myself directly with the bank to get the information that I was looking for. Because it was very difficult to get the information from examiners. So I asked Brian to call Countrywide because we had established relationships directly. And through that, I was able to give just-in-time information that the board was looking for. So I wouldn't get much sympathy when I would call the Reserve Bank and I said, the governor needs this. I would have to go through all sorts of hoops to get it, and by that time, you know, the information becomes stale. And so I had to rely on, direct relationships from the banks, and some banks would happily give us, information like Countrywide and like a few others. Wells was another one.
Do tell the Wells about that.
Right.
Well,
No, I was just going to say I was really impressed when Alexis came back and showed me the PowerPoint. I was really impressed that you've gotten that degree of cooperation from the banks
for
these sets of things.
Well, for this, we have to give credit to the interagency process, and this was vetted by. This got to cooperation. So what this tells you is, when there is cooperation, you can get good information.
Right.
Right.
But the initial one, didn't you go directly to the banks?
Initial ones, we went to the banks, so there was some of that, but eventually to get the depth of information that we needed or got, we got cooperation from all the Reserve Banks. So the point is, when everybody's cooperating, you can get a lot of good information.
I guess I just meant when you did that initial report, though.
Mm-hmm. This one?
The survey went to the banks.
Right.
You know, I was very impressed that you got that degree of information because
there were only
a few companies that were providing it. It was proprietary.
Right.
And you got a degree of cooperation from the banks. It was really fascinating.
Right.
And you must have been spending a lot of time developing those relationships.
Right. So, it wasn't by chance that we didn't know what they could produce. So we did we had some of that, all right, over time.
But they also provided it willingly.
Yes, they did.
So did you? What was your thinking about their decision, their willingness to provide the information? Did they want you to know?
Well, you know, a lot of people did want to help the markets. So, for instance, Herb Sandler,
right,
the CEO of Washington Bank, Golden West, was tremendously helpful. I really feel bad about what happened to him.
He made out like a bandit.
He made out like a bandit, but I think he was very much against, I thought he was very much against what was happening here. And he gave us a lot of good ideas.
Was he one of the people that early on had told you there was becoming a big problem?
Yeah. I mean, he was very honest about... So maybe, I don't know what his ulterior motives were ultimately, how he,
He's very public in his views, too. He commented on Basel, too.
Yeah, he's commented.
Yeah. All right. But he was just one example. But there were other bankers. I think I mentioned to you, hopefully you've spoken to him, the vice chairman of WAMU. What was his name? Former vice chairman of WAMU.
Right.
So he would give us information. Bill Longbreak.
Longbreak, yeah.
Yeah. He would give us information that was not necessarily in the best interest of WAMU, but in the best interest of the markets. So there were a lot of people that I would get calls from, you know, one of the largest hedge fund managers. It was against his, things he would tell me would actually curb his profitability of his hedge fund. So he was looking out for the country. He was saying, you should be aware of this. You know, and so I would, you know, somebody asked me who were some of the unsung heroes were in the financial crisis. I would say it's the public, the citizens that were actually involved in it that really cared and that called the Fed despite the harm it would do to them. They were recommending things that would actually, they would not benefit from.
What was your earliest call like that?
I would say one of the earliest calls was Jim Dondero, the CEO of Highland Capital.
When is this?
This was back in 2006. And then Bill Longbreak was very early on. He called it right. He really said this is going to be the worst financial crisis in history, and he said it back in 2006.
Did you need any persuading?
Six and seven. A little bit. I didn't know, you know, I can say that I knew this was going to be the worst in history. I couldn't say that I knew that all these correlation effects were going to happen. That wouldn't be fair.
But he got your attention.
Yeah, I listened. Because I think he sounded like an intelligent man. He sounded like he backed it up with some facts. And so I listened. I took his story to a number of folks to try to listen. And I think he went to Vice Chairman Cohn as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he knows Vice Chairman.
And that would have been in 2006, same time?
Six and seven.
When you took his story, I'm just curious, like your path of who you would talk to would include? In this case, who?
Well, it would be, Rich Spoonkill then, and then eventually Roger Cole and Deborah Bailey. And I would take some of his information and present it to the chairman.
How did you do that, in writing or?
In data. Chairman always liked data.
Oh, I see.
So I presented him specific facts.
And did he know what inspired it? I mean, in other words, that you'd have this conversation and you'd go and pull data for him, or?
Well, he just said, I want to see this, and so he inspired it.
I see.
Yeah, he was interested. I knew what he was interested in, mm-hmm. at a meeting, and so I just got it from. I'd call up Bill. I said, Bill, need this right away. He would arrange meetings with his analysts, and I would get the information. Because if I went through the Reserve Bank channel, it would take days.
Forget it.
Yes. So you've painted that picture of the Reserve Bank channel being ineffective.
Well, I wouldn't say ineffective. I would say perhaps the cooperation could be improved.
So is there also an econ theory channel that's slightly less ineffective?
Well, economists are made to make, one of their jobs are to make predictions, right? So sometimes their predictions are not always accurate. So the models, they rely on models, and some of those models may not have worked.
Well, it sounds actually like the models didn't include the right inputs. I mean, if we take it from, mm-hmm. from Susan Bies, mm-hmm. the risk models didn't include the right inputs.
She would be closer to it than I. But I can tell from the commentary that the economists were making I didn't agree with them.
I'm sorry?
I didn't agree with them.
Right.
From the comments, public comments.
And are they disproportionately power? I mean, if you could have...
The Fed is the central bank. The key role of the Federal Reserve is monetary policy. That's what the FOMC is about. You know, the FOMC... historically is about monetary policy, central banking, not supervision. So, you know, supervision is not the... Now, under Bernanke, he was always very pro-supervision. Chairman Bernanke, very pro-supervision. But the culture, I think, is dominated by economists. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but that's the way it is.
A bunch of consumer advocates have told us that they also came to the Fed and laid out their concerns and brought in all kinds of stories and reports from the field, and so a lot of other people were also bringing information and reporting it. And they said that one of the problems they felt with Greenspan was that if people brought in whatever stories you brought in, they would always say, "Oh, it's anecdotal. Where's the data?" So you had to get to the point that you could assemble data.
Yeah.
One of the things I would say, looking at this, is it's as wonderful as it was. Mm-hmm. By the time they could get the data, the damage was done. The 18 months that everything got terribly out of hand.
Right.
By the time you have the numbers to track it, you can hardly fix it.
Right. So I think if we had acted back in 2005, we actually got this. I think we could have probably have done more. But by the time it was, 2007, basically, right? And late 2006, 2007, then it's,
And you were pushing for it from 2005.
Right. But the you have to go through this process to get things done.
Wasn't that, as Alexis has said, very frustrating, because you could see the signs getting worse.
Yeah, yeah.
You knew it was going to be a crisis.
Right.
And you had to go in and just keep your cool while you dealt with people who were behaving bureaucratically and kept referring to their economic models.
Right. Well, that's true. And so you have to understand the incentive structure that the taxpayers have put on the regulatory system. So a bureaucrat is not being paid to take risk. That's what incentive does a bureaucrat have to stick their neck out and be ahead of things and then get their head chopped off afterwards? Let's look at the incentive structure of the U.S. regulatory system. So I think that continues. Right? You have a lot of people that want to do the right things, but you can't. The risk-taking culture is not there, and it's not awarded.
Right.
But the
mission of the agencies is to protect.
It's to protect, and in this environment,
get forgotten.
To protect, you have to make some decisions, and make some tough decisions. And if you look at the reaction of making tough decisions when things are going well, and you get the perfect example I'll give it to you, is the commercial real estate guidance. Okay, the things are going well. I can tell you from my personal point of view, I stuck my neck out to do this, and I got penalized for it. My career was definitely hampered by that.
What happened?
Oh, I got lots of very powerful people very angry at me.
Well, you had essentially a split board.
Board.
So you had three friends.
But within not even within the board, within the Federal Reserve System. So, if you want to play the game and move up, you have to play it as. But being able to take risks is not the culture that you have in the regulatory community. You really need a very strong leader with vision who's going to support their people to take similar risks. Then the people will follow. But if the culture is such that you don't take risks, then that's what will prevail. And so you can't blame the people. I think partly it's the structure that's in place.
So that's why you decided that the person who most needed the information was Greenspan, and it needed to be presented as data, and that if his opinion could be changed,
right.
Then
for the Fed to make major changes, right, policy changes, they want to see evidence of that. So there's always been anecdotal support, but in order to make changes. So on the commercial real estate guidance, we came up with the threshold of 300%. So I got pushback on, where did you come up with that number?
I'm sorry, 300%.
300% is if you have concentrations greater than 300%, then X, Y, and Z happens.
And this is the commercial real estate. Real estate. It's not the
Okay.
And so there was pushback from all the agencies, pushback except from the OCC. We got support from the OCC. So OCC was very supportive, including John Dugan. The other agencies were very much against it. We got pushback, and partly from the board and partly from internal, we had to come up with an analysis of why that made sense.
Right.
So we got data, did regression analysis, and proved that 300% actually made sense. And so that then got the support of the Fed internally, and then we got it through. But we got 3,000 letters from the industry saying that this is ridiculous, and letters from Congress and others saying that this is ridiculous, you can't do it.
Yeah, what about Congress's role in all this? We've heard a lot about it, and yeah. I know that Governor Baez also has told us about the pushback from Capitol Hill on anything that
right, absolutely.
Was that
absolutely.
Something that you heard about too?
I felt it. Not only heard about it, I was part of it.
What happened?
Well, we got called to Congress and said, "What are you doing? This is everything is fine. Why do you have it in here?" Basically, the American Bankers Association and all of these big lobbyist firms were. They influenced a lot. So the lesson of it was that going forward, is it worth taking the risk? If I'm going to be a career bureaucrat, right, and I'm going to try to look after my family and keep my job, is that the kind of risk I'm going to take going forward?
You were just talking about Congress and the ABA. Was that in the context of commercial real estate or residential real estate, both?
That was mostly the commercial real estate. That's in writing. We have, we have things that that you can see. You can ask. I think I do remember some things in writing.
Like the comment letters and all that, but
letters from Congress on that issue.
And on the
not on non-traditional. Non-traditional, it was mostly. It was more verbal pressure than something in writing.
Is there a good example that we could use maybe to explain how influence from Congress could change something policy-wise at the Fed? Is there a good example we could use of how it did shift or change based on congressional concerns?
Well, Congress is political, so it'll always be.
We don't have to peg it to you. I'm just saying, is there a good example that we could think of or make sure that we thought of how in this whole period Congress's concerns or pushback had sway with the Fed leadership?
Okay,
can
you
think of an example?
Of course.
A concrete example?
Well, we delayed the implementation of the commercial real estate guidance. That's one. We delayed the implementation of the non-traditional. More explicitly from Congress on the commercial real estate, which is now a big fiasco in the country, they specifically requested implementation to be delayed by a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we had. We said to our examiners, don't implement this fully, give them time, and that allowed the bubble to get even worse.
Okay. And that's a direct result, you think, of the conversation?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And Governor Tarullo asked me this, in my view, of if we didn't delay this by a year, would that have made a difference? And I would say, yes, it did. It would have. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I was going to ask you also in this period of time, were there thoughts that you could share about points along the timeline where you think that changes at the Fed might have made a difference in terms of the crisis, significant difference?
Changes at the Fed?
Changes, if the decisions had been made differently, if there had been action here, there?
Well, I think the nimbleness of the Fed during the financial crisis was great.
Yeah.
You know, so if that type of nimbleness actually existed prior to the actual fiasco, I think that's the kind of nimbleness that we need going forward.
Mm-hmm. But is there an example that you can think of where there were conversations about going down this fork or this fork, mm-hmm. and the decision went a different direction, and if a change in decision had been made, you think there would have been a tangible difference?
As Governor Baez mentioned, there was a lot of debate about the non-playing level field. If somebody at the Fed said, look, let's just do this, you know, this is a major problem, this is it. Somebody had leadership ability to do that, not leadership, but maybe in the culture and environment that allowed somebody to comfortably do that, then I think it would have made a difference. Yeah. Did I answer your question? Okay. Yeah, so what I'm saying is it's very difficult.
You're telling us that the Fed had opportunities to have changed the course of what happened.
Right.
That's your opinion.
But it had.
What you observed?
They could have, but it's very difficult, you see. It's very difficult to do this in an environment where it's not in crisis mode.
Right.
So it was easier. You're in the middle of a crisis. We got to do something now. Versus we're not seeing a crisis. How do you convince everybody else to take this kind of severe action now? And that's the kind of, when you're talking about macro prudential supervision, which this is the buzzword now, right? How are you going to achieve that?
Right.
You have not gotten rid of the structural impediments to allow people to do that.
So your thinking is that not much or not enough has changed?
You have more capital, which will provide additional buffer, but I haven't seen anything changing in the structurally that will actually allow somebody like a Sandiford to go and say, hey, we got to do this, I feel really strongly about it, and let's do something about it, you know. I don't see that kind of culture quite there yet. Maybe that's not the right answer, but I'm saying that there's lots of different, in Washington to make a move, you have to agree to, you know, there are many different factions have to all agree,
mm-hmm.
and then to get all of them to agree, mm-hmm. unless you're in a crisis mode situation,
mm-hmm.
it's very difficult. You have to get the SEC, FDIC, OCC, Treasury,
mm-hmm.
and by the time you get them all agreed to something in a relatively benign environment that you perceive to be a problem, is going to be very difficult.
Yeah.
And how has that actually changed?
It's discouraging, if this is true.
Right. So I don't know if it's true, but that's what I went through, but I don't see anything. So when the economists asked, they wrote this paper on macroprudential supervision at the board.
Mm-hmm.
So say they raised the commercial real estate guidance as a good example of how the Fed was ahead of the curve and identifying something. And I said, well, have you thought about all these other issues in implementation? How does that go away? They said that's still a question in their minds. So
mm-hmm.
so that validates the thinking that these other structural impediments that allows proactive actions are still, are still there, still there. Sorry.
I wanted to ask you about the culture inside the Fed also that allowed this to happen. And I've heard this from various people. We've mm-hmm. heard it from different people. What was sort of the pecking order in the Fed? about, you know, you've talked about the economists having been so powerful inside the organization. Mm-hmm. But did you feel like sort of being an advocate of supervision and risk management that was not viewed in the same light as the people who were the masters of the models?
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And could you talk about that a little bit? Because I've heard it also from consumer advocates, too, that there was sort of a sense of whose opinion mattered more in the organization.
So, you know, the economists are naturally their data junkies, right? They want to, before they make a decision, they want to do good analysis, they want to get good data and then feel comfortable about their decision, right? The problem is, by the time you get good data and good information, it's already too late, right? So that's part of the problem. And in certain cases, with respect to managing the economy, they do have information which they can act on a proactive basis. But the way that we get data, monitoring financial stability, is in the banking system, it's that kind of data gathering process has not been established yet. Yes. And we need to do a better job in that.
I just wanted to ask a couple more questions about the Saturday or the weekend afternoon when Mr. Sample called. Mm-hmm. Did you know him?
Well,
you've been talking to him because of this. Was it a Saturday? Was it a Sunday? Mm-hmm. What day of the week
Saturday.
Was it? It was
Saturday.
A Saturday in the summer, so like nobody's in town here.
Nobody's
in Saturday in the summer. Right. And he's calling you from California.
Yeah.
And so you're at work.
I'm at work, right.
Yeah,
so he took a chance.
Yeah.
He took a chance.
Yeah. And was there some reason that you had a rapport with him that he called?
Well, I just talked to him a week ago about the market.
Okay, so you'd been chatting with him, and you'd been telling
him. Right.
And he knew
and
you were
I met
sympathetic
him,
at this
right,
point.
And I met him, you know, in various meetings when they came to visit Washington.
Right. Well, it's just so interesting. Such a huge company.
Mm-hmm.
And all the contacts a company like Countrywide would have in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
You think of all the contacts all the time he's there.
Mm-hmm.
But when he feels like he's desperate and in need,
mm-hmm.
you're the person.
Well, maybe he tried 1,000 other calls beforehand.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, that's very kind of you to say, but I don't know. Maybe he tried. I was like the 10th person that answered the call. I don't know.
And you're on there on weekends.
I am there on weekends. So I was there
so.
On weekends. Yeah. So.
Right.
Right.
They weren't even.
But I wasn't. I couldn't say I was sympathetic to them. I was maybe someone. If somebody's in need, I'm going to try to help.
Right. Right.
But they were a thrift holding company by then.
Yes.
Yes. So it would have been logical that they would have been calling. They're being regulated by OTS at that point.
Right. They still called us.
Yeah. Right.
That's a good point.
What's your Wells story? You're going to tell us about Wells.
Wells, I found, now this is a good Examiner story, I have to say. The Examiner at Wells was very cooperative with Washington.
Okay.
And the Examiner always helped. Whenever we called, he was always, and even today, the person in charge today, Pat Bunkar, so they're very cooperative. So whenever we needed something, they would say, okay, what do you need? What do you exactly need? We'll go get it for you. And that's what they did. So.
And was that a culture of
I think it was, yeah, San Francisco.
Their
that's their culture, right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I would say, yeah, Janet Yellen was wonderful. She was just, I think it's part of her, she was definitely... part of that set the tone.
Interesting.
Can we go back maybe to some of Tom's risk management questions? He's writing that section. So.
I would also like to, before we quite get there, I think it's a really interesting concept to talk about the people that went out of their way to try to make things work right
mm-hmm.
from the industry. And I'm wondering if on reflection you think of more names and you could just jot down a line or two and send it to the writers. My suspicion is that's a story that's not been told.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is the people that said, wait a minute, something's wrong in this market. The least we can do is tap the policeman on the shoulder and say, we think there's an issue.
Oh, yeah.
And it would be really helpful to, I think, as a lesson learned for other people to understand this is a course of action that might
right.
be quite useful.
Yeah, so I'll give you the names, and they're not too many people because from the banking industry mm-hmm. that actually called. Again, I want just one data point, but maybe they, you know, called others. So based on my perspective at the Fed, there's like you know, five or six people that always called.
Okay.
And so one is a former Goldman Sachs guy, Mike Spath. He's now at a big hedge fund. He's where he called me quite a bit.
His first name is Mike?
Michael Spath, yeah.
Okay.
Bill Longbreak, Jim Dondero.
How do you spell Dondero?
D-O-N-D-E-R-O.
Where is he from?
He's based in Texas, Dallas, Texas, Highland Capital.
Oh, that's fine.
And a couple others I used to call frequently, I'm forgetting now.
And you mentioned Herb Sandler, but
there
Herb may
Sandler,
be others.
Yes, Herb Sandler, right.
There may be others that come to mind. It would be, I think, quite nice to...
Yeah.
At least highlight that there's some people
yeah.
out there.
Yeah.
Did you ever have casual conversations with your colleagues at the Fed about, I mean, was this a rare enough group that you would also share your stories about the cooperative people?
I tried to, I mean, Herb wanted to see the chairman. Mm-hmm. And so the only way I got him to see the chairman was to convince people that he was very helpful. Mm-hmm. But people didn't want him to go see the chairman. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of pushback.
Was right. They didn't want him to go see the chairman?
Afterwards, sorry?
They didn't want him to go see the chairman?
No, because he's a little nutty.
Oh,
he's
sorry.
A,
oh.
Well, Herb Sandler's a little nutty?
Yeah, you never know what he's going to say.
So he rang his bell with you after he sold his business? Is that what you said, or before?
Before.
It was before.
Right, so he was telling me things, a lot of the key components of the non-traditional mortgage guidance came from him. So he was trying to regulate the market. And so I do believe him when he said maybe he wasn't close enough. You know, he's an old guy. He was very, but very smart guy.
How'd the meeting go with the chairman?
Not too. I mean, it went okay.
Oh. What does that mean?
Herb was not shy about expressing his opinions.
Of Mr. Greenspan?
No, about the consumer group.
Oh,
consumer group, right.
The consumer group.
At the Fed.
What was he saying about the CIC?
Well, you know, obviously that our leadership was poor and we didn't do
Sandra
enough.
Sandra Bronstein?
Not Sandra, the other one. The one
uh-huh.
ahead of it, he was criticizing.
Yes,
her.
Right. Uh-huh.
Dolores.
Uh-huh,
yeah.
Right.
So he wanted to use his time with the chairman to talk about the CAC?
Well, he wanted to give him his views about what was going on. So.
But that wasn't all. Was that the only thing he wanted to talk about, or was that the thing that they ended up?
That's what they ended up focusing on. But,
and, of course, the chairman never came to the CAC events, so he didn't really know.
He didn't know at the time, but okay. I think he attends quite a few now.
The current chairman.
The current chairman.
Right. Right.
So at this point,
this
was are you
Bernanke,
talking about, oh, you're talking about Bernanke.
Bernanke.
Well, Bernanke was attending a lot of those.
Yes.
So Herb Sandler was telling him that I've just been reading all those transcripts.
Yeah, okay.
So there was an awful lot of discussion about, there was a whole lot of discussion about what was coming out in these meetings.
Right. So HOPA was coming out at the time.
Yeah, right.
And so he's saying, look, you know, I don't know how good this new lady is, but let me tell you about Dolores. And I hope she's not as dumb as this other reported. You know, those kind of colorful language.
But he was having this conversation with Greenspan or
Bernanke. Yeah.
Well, Bernanke had been sitting in on those meetings for several years and would have observed it unfold. Greenspan never went to any of the meetings.
No, Chairman Greenspan didn't.
You know, but there was an awful lot said in those meetings. Mm-hmm. And it was bankers there with consumer advocates.
Right, right.
The consumer advocates were given very little time to talk. And the meetings were usually run by the bankers.
Right. Yeah. That's true. And they still have the... Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yeah, from a few that I've attended, I would say lately... I would say the consumer folks have more, I might have a biased view given my more recent experience.
Well, after a crisis, you tend to get a little more traction, don't you, from the
consumer side? Right.
They also have to listen a little bit more because so much got predicted in those meetings.
Right.
Which, of course, anyway, so this is fascinating. Thank you so much.
A couple more questions about, I mean, we've really got great information on the non-traditional mortgage banks. And in hindsight, I mean, you can say, why don't we do this or this? But the questions around some of the other credit elements and kind of who was looking at that within the Fed. And mm-hmm. I'm thinking about things like a lot of the stuff that was in the trading books, that mm-hmm. process, securitization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I'll just ask, how was your group involved? Right.
So the trading book was Jim Emberset, as you know.
The board. Credit aspects, to be clear.
The counterparty credit risk, that was sort of like, that should have been in my area, but he wanted it. So
okay.
I just let him have it. But sometimes my analysts would go in and just help him out.
Yeah.
But counterparty credit risk on the trading book side was his area. On the securitization side, that fell under my area, except for MSRs.
Do you think the Fed has sufficient expertise to review structured products? Did we do enough in hindsight?
No, I think that was definitely an area, as you know, with... Tim DeRozier and others, we talked about, boosting up, some of the resources and training, and we talked about conducting a horizontal exam on securitizations, which didn't happen, and so that was definitely an issue.
Why didn't it happen?
I think that. Tim DeRozier was named the head person to conduct the horizontal. And I think his, just the way it was presented, probably didn't go across very well.
What about the components of, like, credit derivatives?
To argue for a horizontal, you have to make a case.
Very much.
Okay, so the way, the quality of his scope document could have been better. And so I think that was part of it.
The other elements in hindsight are some of the financial engineering around credit derivatives, either CDO type structures with CDS or some sort of insurance.
Right.
Your group.
Right. Well, so this is one of the issues, the convergence between the market and the credit group. That's an area, credit risk and market risk. There's convergence over the two areas. I think that's an area that we needed to do a better job in. And we don't have enough people to really understand the two areas very well. The two areas that converge. So we have strong credit risk people,
right.
And we have strong market risk people. But then somebody who understands the area in between the two, I think that's an area that we did not have. And so part of the structure that was created at the Fed forced us to focus on credit risk and another at market risk. simply because we wanted to avoid sort of conflict, so that one could say, well, you're treading in my area versus the other. And so it was easier to focus on some of the pure risks, you know, and deal with that. And then, so what happened is you end up thinking in a one-dimensional point of view. Securitization is credit. From a credit perspective, here's what they need to be. Instead of looking at the, you know, how the credit and market risk together behaves and causes some, you know, unintended consequences. So we didn't work well together to do that.
There were a couple of, in our discussions with various folks, aha-type moments.
Mm-hmm.
I guess just city and sort of discovery of some items that were sort of left out of the capital calculation, like the liquidity puts or and you talked about how the Fed's pretty nimble in crisis mode. Mm-hmm. Were there some examples, you know, as these markets, particularly the CDO markets, started to kind of show a lot of problems, where your group worked with the market folks to kind of figure this out, or were they mostly aha moments, or your experience?
Well, so CDO squared and CIVs and you know, those kinds of, those are the two areas I remember we played an active role in. And then the CDSs, we were always quite active in that. That was more for credit risk mitigation and policy development rather than on, and for the crisis mode, it was the CIVs and CDO squared and the mortgage insurance, bond insurance. Those are the areas we played a more active role in.
When you looked at credit risk, I'm sorry, one quick question. Would you look at the way an institution would price for risk and sort of that trade-off? Because we get a sense that particularly once the CDOs kicked in, pricing got really skewed where people ended up paying an awful lot for an awful lot of risk. Was that something that was in your area?
Well, yes. So in a way, so that was that's a question many people would get asked, including the economists. So Chairman Bernanke would often ask, "You're seeing all this liquidity. Do we feel that the risk is appropriate, or the price is appropriate for the risk?" So I remember him asking that question a number of times to the people attending the meeting. And so not necessarily directly towards me, but in general towards. And so we would go back and think about whether it was being priced appropriately. And so you would tie that to the losses, the expected losses. And so that's how sort of the stress test exercise came about. So so you look at whether the returns on the loans were appropriate for the losses, the expected losses the loans were going to get, and then based on that you look at whether the capital was adequate. So if the pricing was adequate, then you would see that the capital was going to be adequate. But then what the stress test showed was that the expected losses were going to exceed the income that was going to come in.
And we found a number of institutions that simply failed to allocate capital to certain risk concentrations. And so they would look at it and say, we have, you know, this CDO bucket or whatever is a small percentage of our total assets, but they would fail to think about what percent is it of my capital to be allocated for this. Mm-hmm. Would that be the kind of issue you would get into, or was that divided with another group that was struggling with capital questions?
So I'm sorry,
would your credit risk unit deal with allocation of capital to concentration of credit risk,
I'm trying to figure out.
We're dealing with the management of the risk.
In all different ways.
In all different ways.
Great.
And that would include whether the capital was adequate.
Okay, great.
You were talking a minute ago about the liquidity in the market, the proper pricing of various risks. Did you focus at any time on cities' concentration of liquidity facilities? The fact that city had about 50% of the liquidity facilities in the market.
In what?
The liquidity facilities on the CDOs, the liquidity puts.
Right, right.
And similar liquidity facilities.
We had discussions about liquidity facilities, but through the LFI committee process, I don't remember seeing an analysis on that.
Okay. You don't recall any time just having a conversation about, wow, this is pretty much a city problem?
No.
I'd like to ask about risk management, if I might, for a minute. I guess it was Tolstoy, all happy families are alike. Mm-hmm. Well, what I look at is, we've looked now at about 9 different institutions, mm-hmm. and it's the unhappy ones that seem to have made every mistake in the book. Mm-hmm. And there are relatively few that really were successful. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious your perspectives, mm-hmm. you know, which institutions, as you look at them, mm-hmm. were better at managing risk mm-hmm. than others, and sort of what was going on there, what the essential ingredients were mm-hmm. that allowed them to be superior to mm-hmm. the others.
Yeah, I would say, you know, there's been a number of studies done on this, and so, you know, I would agree with those observations, the SSG named one. And so, so the things that stand out in my mind is one is the tone from the top,
yeah.
and the culture that it creates. And so normally the risk managers in a bank are considered second class citizens.
Yes.
And so to the extent risk managers and business line people are considered partners, that would be a good indication. Secondly is the ability of management to get the right information to monitor and assess the riskiness of what's going on.
Now, were these factors known and understood in the supervisor context in the mid-2000s? And not, I mean, SSG
yeah.
did their report terms, or they did their interviews at the end of 2007, report right. 2008.
Right. So if you look at, you know, they talk about if we need a lot more new guidance. I don't think so, because it's all there. The principles are all there. So, you know, tone from the top, and good MIS systems,
yeah.
Having the right risk controls and process controls, right capital, that's all there. Stress testing, those are all old concepts, nothing new.
I mean, it was funny when we asked about San Francisco and you came up with Wells and Countrywide. Countrywide had its risk officer layered about 3 levels below the CFO at one point. And Wells seems to have done pretty well. What is your sense of that? Why would they have done better? And were there costs attached to not joining the party?
Yeah. Well, mainly because credit is not something that you can model. Credit is an art. And
great, thanks.
Can I ask one last mm-hmm. Question? Mm-hmm. Maybe
I still have a couple more.
Sure.
If you don't mind.
Sure.
The examiner's conundrum and kind of lay actions, and wondering if you know, thinking about Herb Sandler mm-hmm. And the Wachovia case. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're involved mm-hmm. at the end there, but you know, a lot of subprime banks have gone mm-hmm. down by that point. Mm-hmm. Wachovia is still hanging on, and the losses really didn't show up until late in the game.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think were factors, or were you aware of, in
that caused the Wachovia
meltdown down there? Yeah,
yeah. It was an FDIC action that basically said that the on the weekend that the what the subprime, well, not the subprime, but the subordinate debt holders were basically useless. And so, you know, the market reacted negatively to that.
The other thing I was thinking about is the Golden West portfolio itself. It was pretty late, you know, before problems were recognized. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you were involved with the
OTS,
Richmond Reserve Bank or whatever, and kind of, you know, what about this portfolio?
Yeah, I mean, as part of the non-traditional mortgages, we were always talking to them about, you know, what kind of assessment do you have on their non-traditional mortgage guidance. And there again, we didn't get any information on them. They said, we're on it, we understand it's a risk, we're monitoring it. So that's as much as we got from the Richmond Fed.
Mr., if I could take you back for a minute to Vice Chair Longbreak. You mentioned that he came to you and spoke to you about some things he foresaw in 2006. Was he concerned about WAMU's
participation? Yes, very much so.
And could you tell us about that? Because things didn't work out well.
Right. Well, he was an outsider. He got kicked out of the, you know, the insider because the chairman was not listening to him. So, so he was telling them to get out, do this, but they wouldn't listen to him. So, yeah, he was very concerned about WAMU.
I have three really. When you were last here, you told us a fascinating story about a field trip you made to New York to talk to the ratings agency.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to the Fed to ask them about the memo to the file, and they couldn't locate anything that described what had taken place earlier. So, would you mind just giving us a feel again for that 2005 visit to New York? And I just want to make sure that we understand what your conclusions were at that point in time about the ratings agencies, what they were doing. You talked about it as they were trying to explain it was a blip, because you were concerned about what you were. And then anything that goes forward after that period so that we can just tidy up what we were talking about with ratings agencies.
So one of the main intents of taking that trip was to rattle their cage.
Mm-hmm.
So we went there as Fed officials talking to them to, you know, say, we're concerned. We're looking at this. What's your view? And so they basically said, don't worry about it. This is going away. It's not a big problem.
Mm-hmm.
So we came back. We weren't convinced. We were still monitoring the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's really it. That was it.
So 2005, several more years spool out before disaster strikes.
Yeah.
You're skeptical, you're watching them, you don't have any control over what they're doing.
Right.
Was there anything else that the Fed did that we should be thinking about that was looking at this, concerned about it, trying to get more data?
Well, let's see. You know, we issued the subprime the guidance. That was in 2007, right? Yeah. And then that summer is when the financial crisis basically hit. That's when Countrywide called. And, you know, since then we've just been on, or the Fed had just been on reactive mode.
Okay. So really nothing else was done after that other than you put them on notice that you were watching, and that was about it. That's all you
nothing,
can do?
Nothing to the rating agencies.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean we're not supervising them, so that's something.
Did they do anything differently in relationship with the Fed? Provide additional information or try to be good students? Or
well, they were good. They would always answer our calls. Yeah.
So they were cooperative.
They were cooperative. Yeah, okay. They were cooperative.
I have two other quick questions. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you want to add about Fannie and Freddie from your experience that we should be thinking about from where you sat?
Right. So I think the regulator has improved since then. And so, you know, if you just did a simple stress test on their 10-Ks, you could figure out that they're defunct. And the thing is that the market didn't pick that up either. So, you know, disclosure was there. Mm-hmm. And so it took a long time before Wall Street picked that up. Mm-hmm. And so I would just say, you know, if you have people that are managing money and doing all the sort of analysis, they should really do their homework. Because a lot of people didn't do it.
Mm-hmm. What impact do you think that Fannie and Freddie had on the crisis?
We've heard very large.
Not a lot of interviews. There's a lot of information provided that they weren't causal, but very much complications. What's your feeling about it being causal or complication?
They drove down the underwriting standards for conventional mortgages, which trickled to the other areas.
So they're very much part of it.
Absolutely.
And
no doubt about it.
When would that have taken place, roughly? Just about.
I think when we were doing our survey, we you know, at least in 2005, we asked about their underwriting standards, and they definitely started. They loosened them up, no doubt. Yeah. They're far from being clean. I would say definitely not.
And then I had a last question, and there might be follow-ups here. We're watching something that we don't know how it will end with the foreclosure mess.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any, and I know you're not there mm-hmm. anymore, you're joined, but do you have any perspective on what may be simmering here?
Mm-hmm. So this foreclosure issue has been around for some time, right?
Okay.
I mean, you have all these different programs, Treasury, the HAMP program, and other mm-hmm. programs. And so, the government, I think, has been looking at this issue for some time. I'm in a bit of a quandary as to why this is now bubbling right now. And so this robo agreement thing that... I think, we should try to help alleviate the process, because this is really going back to people that are not paying their mortgages,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the country's got to do something about this,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you forestall and don't do it, it's just going to make
mm-hmm.
it go.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully there'll be an easy solution to this technical issue
mm-hmm.
about how do you process all these foreclosed loans.
Well, when you say the government had knowledge of this, do you mean that there was an understanding that in the haste to create these products, that the paper trail that would have existed in an older, slower time
mm-hmm.
had been corrupted or had gone awry? You're saying that there was acknowledgement of that long at some distance in the past?
No, I wouldn't say the regulators knew that the process and controls were I don't think they knew explicitly that that was a problem. They knew that there were pressures in the servicers. The servicers were having problems keeping up with all these problem loans, right?
Right.
And so I don't think that translated into whether, there were just outright failures in compliance. So they were saying they were losing some money because they couldn't keep up with the costs, but then they were hiring more people to deal with it. So what I think from the examiner's perspective, we did hear people taking, them taking actions. But I don't think examiners understood some pretty serious disregard on compliance issues.
And when you say that your feeling is that there should be an effort to try to clean this up and let's move on,
mm-hmm.
do you feel that there's, as some people have suggested, another crisis looming if this spools out over some long period of time? In other words, that there's investors filing lawsuits, they want their money back, or they want, this goes on and on
right.
back into Wall Street?
Right, if it spreads, it's a
dangerous
situation.
So you're concerned that might happen?
You need to monitor it, yes. So Fannie and Freddie has subpoenaed, I think, 1.6 million loans.
Mm-hmm.
The investors are thinking about, suing.
Yes.
So, so you need to monitor the situation, absolutely.
Okay.
But the way that you can deal with that is, but this situation existed 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So what is different now than what happened 2 years, what existed 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
That's what I don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's going to slow down the cleaning up the home the housing market, because you do need foreclosures to happen to allow for price discovery. But so I think that's what I don't understand is this investor situation always existed, and what's bubbling now that didn't exist before. I suppose one thing is they've lost further confidence that the banks originated mortgages consistent with their disclosures.
Right. And the last thing I want to ask about this is do you have any good assessment of why it is that it appears, at least on the surface, to be so challenging to get the banks to modify? That there's this tension between what the administration or Washington would like the lending institutions to do versus what they would prefer to do with foreclosure. What are we missing here about why it's so
charge-offs?
It's the money.
Yeah, it's the money.
So if we just say that would be true.
Yeah.
There's much more financial incentive for them to foreclose on the house.
Than to modify?
Yes.
I would say probably,
Is that because when you start charging off, you then have to draw inferences about the remainder of your loans that you haven't charged off?
Partly.
Is it the problem of having to mark down
the workouts, a lot of people simply cannot afford the mortgage, right? And then to bring it down to a level where they can afford it is probably greater than the amount of charges they'd have to take in a foreclosure. And so that could be part of it. Another part is not getting enough information. So when the servicer is calling the borrowers, they're not answering.
Oh, they talk about it the other way.
Really? Yeah. So they don't trust the servicers. That's what we've heard. And so that's why these different community organizations are helping with the servicers. But part of it is the regulations, require them to, we're not forbearing on these, the regulators are not forbearing on the modifications. So, asset quality issues, charge-offs is a part of it. Foreclosures are charged off too, but it's the difference between the two.
Thank you, that's helpful.
Sure.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a few questions just sort of trying to put things together into a narrative, which is part of what we're doing. How many different presentations do you think you made to officers about, from these sets of papers? How many different presentations do you think you made?
Let's see, I'm counting them, but there's three here, right? So probably did this at least 10 times.
And where did you do it?
We made it internally at the board, gave it to economists across the street, reserve banks, a number of reserve banks.
Did you do that in person or?
Person or by phone.
Or by phone.
Yeah.
When you did it here, where did you give the presentations here?
We gave it to the boardroom. We gave it to the, different conference rooms.
And you said there were only a few times that you managed to make it all the way through the presentation. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So what would happen? I mean, it seems to me like it was really important information you were giving them, and I'm surprised they didn't stay till the end. What would happen?
Once I gave it?
Yeah, when you started to give it, you said that
they would jump ahead and start asking questions, and then one question would lead to another, and then time was over.
Did you feel like you got a chance to fully brief them?
I think they got the main points.
Uh-huh.
I think the main points were conveyed.
And so would you say that most of the time when you gave the presentation, was it a neutral response, or did you usually immediately get a somewhat emotional response pretty quickly?
The one I remember, some were just very quiet, you know, because depending on the audience, but the meeting with the governors was quite energetic.
Uh-huh. And did people take different sides?
Mm-hmm.
And were you able to get through your whole presentation there, or did people leave?
Well, I mean, they had to move on to another agenda topic, but I don't think we were able to finish, but we were able to zone in on the main points. So we jumped around a lot and zoned in on the main points.
Could you describe what kinds of things people were saying? You said that they were saying this isn't a level playing field, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. you're going to stifle innovation. Were those mm-hmm. the kinds of things? Did it get personal?
Yeah, it got very personal. A comment like, well, my hairdresser is the first time that, well, it probably gives away what it is, but my hairdresser is the, you know, can afford a home because of this product.
Can.
Uh-huh. And, if you take this product away, you're not going to be able to afford a home anymore. So how many more people like that are you going to affect?
So in other words, you were being accused of actually like trying to come up with something that was going to take
depriving the American dream of
blue-collar people that deserved a home.
Right.
Are you making the hairdresser, is that something that you just came up with
No, that's what he was told.
So let's think of people who have hair.
There's a few bald ones. So it turned like very personal that this would be something that it ceased to be a strictly an intellectual discussion over risk,
right.
but an emotional discussion over
mm-hmm.
the American dream and
right.
who deserves what on what terms.
Right, and at that time, mortgages, the loss rates of mortgages are very low.
Right.
Right, and people were always deemed to pay their mortgages.
Right.
2% high loss rate historically.
That's right.
Right, I mean, you never...
The good old days, right?
Good old days, yeah. Right. So, you know, and they didn't see this product as being, you know, that bad, some of them.
Right. Did they really understand the product? I mean, I heard a lot of mm-hmm. stories around that time of... people that, you know, even governors not really understanding mm-hmm. the products. It's so different than the products they grew up mm-hmm. with.
Yeah, so I can't say that they did not or did understand. I mean, I think they were looking in some cases a very big picture, macroeconomic way. And so Governor Baez is different. She's very detailed. She was a banker. She's, you know, likes to talk about credit and accounting.
And she has a background in risk.
So
right.
she's, you know, she could really delve into this
right.
stuff. So to have similar expectations of other governors may not be something reasonable.
And there was about a split. And you really, at that point, wouldn't have known which way it was going to go.
Well, we knew it was going to go out.
You knew the guidance was going to go out.
Yeah. I mean, I think, and that's where, you know, I could tell if vice chairman did not have the backing of the chairman, it wouldn't have
right.
gone out. So he spoke
right.
very strongly about this going out, the need to go out.
Right.
So if he didn't have Greenspan's backing, he wouldn't have been so.
When do you think it was that Greenspan changed his opinion on this?
I think he probably when we got the shout from vice chairman said you got to start working on this, get it out.
So that was about when would you say just to
probably first quarter of that year.
The first quarter of
2006 or so.
Of 2006.
Yeah, or I think so.
Well, the proposal went out in December of 2005.
So it must have been that 2005.
The survey, the horizontal survey, mm-hmm. was a couple months before.
Yeah, so I think it was probably 2005.
Well, the home loan one came out in 2005. The home equity loan one came out in 2005.
Yeah.
So the non-traditional...
came out in 2007, but the whole exercise of starting it...
Yeah,
right.
It was like a year.
Right. Yeah, right.
So it was about 6 months into it that he finally decided that he was going to do it for sure, right?
Yeah.
Does that sound
so
right?
I think maybe what we... Yeah, I think it's probably
think it
first quarter 2006.
I think it's 2006,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Right. And did you ever hear about there ever having been any incident that might have changed his mind? Or just the presentation of the data possibly having had an effect?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Herb Sandler thing, mm-hmm. when he and Bernanke, did they fight?
No.
Did they come to blows?
No,
what
no,
happened?
The chairman never fights. He's a very
very cool head. But what happened? It was just...
he was blasting the CCA and basically suggesting to the chairman some of the things he should be doing.
And suggesting things that he should be doing in connection
forward.
With that and going forward.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In other words, pushing additional guidance.
Right. HOPA, make sure you get that right.
Not just offering direction to examiners, but announcing rule making that could change.
Right, right. And he
called more aggressive action, right?
Right. Exactly.
And that's what Sandler wanted.
In essence, yes. Yeah. Particularly in the consumer area.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for all your time.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it.